Well, good evening. It is good to have everybody here. If you're just joining us, we've been studying the Battle of Origins, which is basically the debate between creation and evolution. We're in lesson number 4, scientific case for creation. We looked at the biblical case for creation in lesson number 3. Now we're looking at the science, looking at the evidence that proves that evolution is false and creation is true. We begin by noticing that there's a law of causality, or the law of cause and effect. That law states that for every material effect, there must be an adequate antecedent cause. Antecedent means before. So something had to be before. Gave the example of having a book here on the table and it gets knocked off. We can kind of determine maybe what caused it to be knocked off. We know that the book itself did not cause that. If there was an ant crawling across the table, we know that didn't cause it because it's not adequate enough. But if I come in here and there were kids playing around up here and a book's laying in the floor, I could probably kind of assume that probably one of the kids knocked it off. That's an adequate cause. When we come to creation, or the beginning of the universe, evolutionists have a problem. They don't have an adequate antecedent cause. Christians do. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We also looked at the law of biogenesis. This states that life comes only from preceding life of its own type and kind. There was a time when people thought that some life forms began spontaneously. But Louis Pasteur put an end to that in 1859, and his experiments and proved that life does not develop or come about spontaneously. And so scientists today teach that that does not happen. But yet they turn around as they teach our kids in school and say spontaneous generation has been proven false. They turn around and say, well, life began spontaneously. It began out of nothing. So they're not being consistent. We also began, or we end, I think, our lesson last week, talking about DNA. Deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, is the molecule that carries the genetic instructions used in the growth, development, functioning, and reproduction of all known living organisms. DNA is the code of life. It's the program of life. We talked about the fact that we all have these little computers. It's all put together by material, and it just sits there. Unless there's a program in it, and then another program reads it and activates it. There's lots of computer programmers out there. They write code. And all it is putting these little programs in the computers. But the code is nothing more than just numbers and letters written down on a piece of paper, or in most cases, inside of a computer. But it doesn't do anything unless something reads it, activates it, and causes it to work. Well, it's the kind of same way with the DNA. DNA is the genetic code of life. But it's kind of like a blueprint for a building. It just sits there unless something acts upon it. That something that acts upon it is RNA, ribonucleic acid, RNA. It works with DNA and causes things to come to life. RNA is a molecule essential in various biological roles, encoding, decoding, regulation, and expression of genes. We saw two videos. One showed a single cell, and we saw it divide itself. Now it was two cells, two identical cells. The DNA code inside replicated itself. The chromosomes divided so that now when it duplicated itself, it was exactly the same, both sides. And then it divided again. Cell division is called mitosis. And there's four phases to that. There's prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. And then the cell divides, which is called cytokinetics. And as I said last week, this is the best science class you ever had because there's no test. You don't have to remember all this stuff. The point I'm trying to make is the fact that those single cells, they look pretty simple, especially looking under a microscope, but they are complicated. This is just touching the surface of what happens when a cell divides. There's so much going on that it could not have happened by itself. And yet that's what scientists want us to believe. We noted that there are only two categories that we can put everything into. We noticed earlier in our lesson that everything that exists can be classified as either matter or mind. There is no other category. Everything that we know about can be put in those two categories. Matter is physical, mind is spiritual. Logically, we could say that everything that exists is either matter or mind. As I said, no third category. Something exists now, so that means something eternal exists. If nothing existed in the past, we would still have nothing today, because nothing creates nothing. But something exists. You and I exist. The universe exists. So what does that mean? That means that something has always existed. And it's either matter or mind that's eternal. We had noticed earlier in our lesson that matter is not eternal. Scientists even say that now. Remember that article in Time magazine in 2001 where scientists made this great discovery? Remember what that discovery was? The world's going to end. Up to that point, they had really tried to convince themselves and others that the universe was eternal. That's really what they wanted. They wanted the universe to be eternal. Why? They wouldn't have to explain the beginning. But they finally owned up to the fact that the universe is not eternal. Matter did not create itself, or it had a beginning, and it will also have an end. So matter is not eternal. Like I said, even evolutionists say that. So what are we left with? Something has to be eternal. The only thing that can be left is the mind is eternal. Mind being spirit. So that's the logical argument for God. Something has always existed. What is it? God. Robert Agros and George Stancy wrote in their biology textbook titled The New Biology. It was written in 1987. And these guys, I don't know a whole lot about their background, but apparently they're not staunch evolutionists. It seems like they maybe believe in creation. There are a few of those guys out there. They said, what cause is responsible for the origin of the genetic code and directs it to produce animal and plant species? It cannot be matter, because of itself, matter has no inclination to these forms, like a microchip or any other artifact. Again, matter isn't going to create itself. Matter doesn't go out there and create other matter. So, what's the origin of the genetic code? How did that code come into existence? And again, when you look at this PowerPoint presentation, this is very basic, very, very simple. But behind what you're seeing is a code. Computers only talk in what? Ones and zeros. On or off. Everything you see up there is ones and zeros. Or comes from ones and zeros. That's the only thing that a computer knows and understands. So what you're seeing behind the background, or what you can't see behind the background, is something fairly complicated, but it's something that man has created. Genetic code, on the other hand, is something that God created, and it is infinitely more complicated than that program. And we know that this program that you're looking at up there didn't happen by itself. Therefore, we can assume and know that the genetic code did not happen by itself. They go on to say, there must be a cause apart from matter that is able to shape and direct matter. Then he asked the question, or they asked the question, is there anything in our experience like this? Think for a moment. What is it that shapes matter? If you're going to build this building, what's the first thing that's going to happen? What? Somebody's going to think about it. The concept has to be there. So, is there anything in our experience like this that shapes and directs matter? He says, yes, there is. Our own minds. The statue's form originates in the mind of the artist, who then subsequently shapes matter in the appropriate way. For the same reasons, there must be a mind that directs and shapes matter in organic forms. Again, DNA did not happen by itself. It was thought of first. And God talks about the fact that before the earth was created, he already had everything laid out and designed. He thought about it first. And then he acted upon it. His mind. The mind of God. Spoke it into existence. They are describing the law of causality, which states that every material thing must have an adequate antecedent cause. How did the universe begin? First, it began in the mind of God. How does the statue come into existence? First, it comes into the mind of some artist. A drawing, a painting, whatever you want to think about. It first is thought about in the mind of someone. It doesn't happen by itself. We know that it takes a human mind to think about and build a camera, a house, a car, a computer, a painting, a sculpture, and so on. Yet we're told to believe that the universe, the earth, and all the life that is in it just happened by accident. That just doesn't make sense. It's not logical. And more importantly, it's not the truth. We're not an accident. The universe is not an accident. The fact that this earth is 93 million miles away from the sun is not an accident. That the earth is tilted on its axis but on 23 degrees, that's not an accident. It's not an accident that we have the moon, the distance that it is away from earth, and the size that it is. All of those are facts put into place by God so that life can exist here on this earth. Matter did not create itself. It was created by a mind. A mind that we call God. Any questions, comments? Quiet group.
We know we're not spontaneous.
No, we're not here by an accident.
Hey, Bob, a few years ago I was reading an article about natural resources. A lot of scientists came together at this convention and they had determined that we would eventually run out of our natural resources.
We will. I'm not going to get into that in this lesson, but there's a couple other laws that you can look at. First law of thermodynamics and a second law of thermodynamics. The first law says that matter can neither be created or destroyed. We create things, but all we're doing is reshaping things. We're not creating matter. Only God can create matter. When we take water, for example, you can freeze it and make ice. You can heat it up and make a gas. You burn wood. Even though that wood pile is no longer there, the matter is still there in some form or shape. A few of it's going to be ashes, a lot of it's going to be heat, some type of gas. So it's kind of like a closed environment of what we live in. Nothing new is brought in and nothing is taken out. It's all there. The second law of thermodynamics talks about the fact that we are using up resources. Even though the matter is still there, it's not as usable as it once was. If you burned all the trees and didn't have any way to grow new trees, we'd be without trees, we'd be without wood. If we mine all of the aluminum or get it out of the ocean, we use it all up and put it in our little landfills, what's going to happen? There is no new aluminum. We will be digging up landfills and using the aluminum that we buried years ago. But it's just saying that we can't create matter. Matter cannot be destroyed. It can change form. But the usefulness of matter is being diminished over time to the point that we will use everything up. But I don't think we have to worry about that. I'm sure long before that time comes, God's going to say, time's up. And Jesus is going to come back. So we don't worry about things like that. People that don't believe in God, they worry about things like that. So it is kind of interesting in the fact that we put our faith and trust in God. He's going to take care of us. He's going to provide for us. He's going to give us the things that we need. We know that. So we don't need to worry about what's going to happen to the earth in 250,000 years. We may not even be here. Okay, let's move on. Let's briefly look at two other scientific areas that show creation to be true. The law of probability and also the fossil record. We'll begin with the law of probability. This law is used in many aspects of our life. Most of us probably never give it a thought, don't think about it, but it's all around us. It's a way to calculate the total probability of an outcome or the odds of something happening. For example, James Coppedge, a former director in probability research, stated, "Probability is a practical concept. The uncertainties of chance affect our everyday lives. How likely is it to rain on a particular day on which you plan to have an outdoor activity? What are the odds that your airline flight will be hijacked? Is there a good chance that your car will operate without major repairs if you delay trading it in for 6 months? What amount of cash will probably be sufficient to take on a planned overseas trip? What's the likelihood that you will pass a certain exam in school course without more study?" Now, we generally don't think of these things in probability, but we think in these terms. You know, at the beginning of the year, in my pickup truck, I thought my tires were good enough until this fall. Before it turned winter, I get a new set of tires. Guess what? Well, about 2 months ago, I had a flat come to church on Sunday morning, and I was late. And David was in a panic. Where is Bob? So I had to buy new tires. So anyway, I played the odds. I thought, okay, I can get by for the summer. And that didn't happen. So we do this all the time, probability. Again, we don't think of it in terms of probability. But we play this little game all the time. Dr. Coppedge goes on to explain that probability studies are useful in such things as calculation of insurance rates, Terry, analysis of stock market principles and our prices, and other such items of everyday interest to the average person. Terry deals with insurance. That's all insurance is, probability. What's the odds that something's going to happen? If you're going to buy insurance or life insurance, and say you're 20 years old, is it going to cost less or more than a guy like me that's 60-something? Quite a bit less for that 20-year-old. Why? Because the odds of him living longer are a lot greater than me living longer. Car insurance. They ask you all kinds of questions about your car insurance. How many wrecks have you had in the last 5 years? They want to know your what score am I talking about? Credit score. They want to know how old you are. They want to know where you live. Why? Because all of that depends or points to a probability. If you live out in the country, the chances of being in an accident is probably less than if you lived in downtown St. Louis. If you're 25 years old, the odds are, or say 16 years old, your odds of getting into a wreck is probably greater than somebody that's 40 years old. So all of that comes into insurance companies play this probability game. What are the chances I'm going to have to pay out something to this person? And so the rates are adjusted accordingly. Stock markets are all, everything's probability. R.L. Wysong said that probability studies are proven and trustworthy. The whole of science and everyday practical living is based upon the right reliability of the probable happening and the improbable not happening.
Good gambler.
Do what?
You have to be a good gambler.
Good gambler, yeah. Indeed, whether most people realize it or not, our daily lives are affected by such mathematical studies, sometimes in ways we do not even know or understand. But it's the odds. What are the chances of something happening? But are matters of probability useful in the creation-evolution controversy? That's the question. You know, we've been talking about probability. We know that it's used in our lives. We know that we use it from time to time. Most of the time, we don't give it a second thought, but we still use it. But is this useful in our study between creation and evolution? Yes, it is. You may wonder why or how. Dr. Coppedge said that evolution is an ideal subject in which to apply the laws of chance. As defined earlier, the evolutionary doctrine denies advanced planning and has random matter in motion as its basic causal source. Chance mutations furnish the variability upon which presently accepted evolutionary thinking in America is generally founded. What do evolutionists say? Was the universe planned? No. It was just an accident. So what are the odds that something like that would happen? What's the probability of something like that happening? Yes. None, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So anyway, that's what he's saying here. The evolutionists have made their point that evolution is an accident. They're chance mutations. They say the mutations happened and for somehow it was always a good mutation. Things got better and improved. But we know that mutations generally what? Make things worse. So anyway, looking at probability and comparing that with evolution, let's see what we can find. We cannot do scientific experiments that will prove or disprove evolution. So we must rely upon the probability of something happening. Since probability studies deal with randomness and since evolution in its entirety is built upon the very concept of randomness, because nothing is following a pattern, everything is just an accident. The one cell happened to accidentally divide into another cell, and that cell again divided, and somehow it created life of all forms. is built upon the very concept of randomness. It would appear that the laws of probability could shed some light on the possibility of evolution having occurred. That is why Dr. Culpidge remarked, "A central question we will be investigating is this. Do the laws of chance allow one to consider evolution as being within the realm of conceivable probability?" Again, the insurance company defines things really well in probability statistics. What are the odds that this person is going to have a car wreck in this particular area at his age? And they're basing their whole economic financial, whatever, of their company on this. If they're right, they make money. If they're wrong, they can go broke. So they're pretty exact in these things. So, do the laws of chance allow one to consider evolution as being within the realm of conceivable probability? Borel's law of probability states that the occurrence of any event where the chances are beyond 1 in 1 followed by 50 zeros is an event that we can state with certainty never will happen, no matter how much time is allotted and no matter how many conceivable opportunities could exist for the event to take place. What is evolution based their theory on? Chance and time. They want time. And they've given themselves like 15 billion years of time as far as the universe is concerned. Time. But what does he say? There comes a point that no matter how much time you give it, it is never, ever going to happen. And he states it's a number 1 followed by 50 zeros. Can anybody tell us what that number is? I have no idea. It's a big one. And to me, it's amazing that it's that big. But it's a big one. Is that what it is? Well, this is a big number.
I guess they used a computer. I don't know what they fed into it.
Yeah, but... Anyway, if a number is bigger than this, if the chances of something gets to a number bigger than this, that event is never, ever going to happen, no matter how many chances you give it, no matter how much time you give it. Just not ever going to happen. Notice these probability estimates regarding the formation of life from a purely mechanistic process. Dr. Morowitz estimated that the probability for the chance formation of the smallest, simplest form of a living organism known is 1 chance in 1/10 to the 340th power, millionth power. That is 1 chance out of 1 followed by 340 million zeros. I didn't take the time to put that on the screen. I'd still be doing it. The size of this figure is truly staggering, since it is more than the supposed electrons and protons in the whole universe. Carl Sagan said that in 1997, excuse me. Protons, electrons are what make up an atom. So that number is bigger than all the atoms in the universe. And that number is greater than the 1 followed by the 50 zeros. And this is what he says, his estimate for the probability of a chance formation of the smallest, simplest form of a living organism. That is vastly larger than Borel's law of 1 in 50 zeros. The late Carl Sagan estimated that the chance of life evolving on any given single planet, like the Earth, is 1 chance in 1 to 10 to to 2 billionth zeros, 2 billionth power. This figure is so large it would take 6,000 books or 300 pages each just to write the number. That number is simply mind-boggling. The number is so large that it's definitely beyond the one followed by 50 zeros, which is Borel's upper limit for such an event to occur. So what are the scientists themselves saying?
Impossible.
It's impossible. The law of probabilities says it can't happen. So why do they still teach it? Why do they still believe it? Could be grants from the government. Could be they just don't want to believe in God.
Maybe not enough opposition.
Not enough people out there telling the truth. There is, according to Borel's law of probability, absolutely no chance that life could have evolved spontaneously on the earth. The law of probability says it can't happen. I don't care how much time you give it. You can put all the billions of years you want into it. It's not going to happen. The law of probability shows us that it is statistically and logically impossible for the universe and everything in it to have created itself. Claude Tresmont, a philosopher of science from the University of Paris, stated this: "No theory of chance can explain the creation of the world. Before chance can send atoms whirling through an infinite void, guess what? The atoms have to exist. What has to be explained is the being of the world and matter. It makes no sense to say that chance can account for the creation of being, existence of life." And this is what the evolutionists always are faced with. Where did it all begin? If God didn't create it and matter is not eternal, how did it get here? And they can't explain it. They have no logical reason. So they always have their back against the wall when it comes to the beginning of the universe. Sproul, Gerstner, and Lindsley, three other scientists, said this: "What are the real chances of a universe created by chance?" As Don said, not a chance. Chance is incapable of creating a single molecule, let alone an entire universe. So what are the chances that everything happened by accident? Not a chance. All the scientific laws point against it. The law of causality, the law of biogenesis, the law of thermodynamics, which I don't have it on the screen, we talked about it briefly. Law of probability. All of these point against evolution.
And Bob, of all those numbers where they're refusing to believe in God, eternity's bigger than all three of them put together.
Yep, it is. So the law of probability shows us that the theory of evolution should be rejected as an explanation for the existence of the universe because it is both statistically and logically impossible. So what about the theory of evolution? Simply stated, it's false. Any questions, comments?
Something new from that?
Yeah, well, they've learned a few things of that, but they hasn't given them the answer to how life began outside of God. They can't accept God, so they have to figure out some other way. But science is interesting.
I guess really we should be thankful for others. A lot of things invented out of the guise of probability or curiosity, and those things we get benefit out today. We know many things. So they were experiments, like you say, scientists were experimenting, trying to prove something else, and found out something else that turned out to be something good.
But they're still using stuff that was given to us by God.
God, yeah. Like I said, that's the first law of thermodynamics. Matter can neither be created or destroyed. We're not creating anything new. We reshape things. But no matter what mind comes with, as far as man is concerned, we have to use what we already have here. We can reshape it, redo it, whatever. But evolution, as we've learned all the way through this lesson, has a big problem. Their very laws that they stand on, the laws that they say are absolute, prove your theory wrong. And yet they're not willing to say that. Now, Dr. Wall, I think it was talking about, he knows a spontaneous generation is impossible. He said that. But yet, how did life begin? Spontaneous generation. Things must have been different in the past than what they are now, he says. Yeah, they were different. God created everything. Okay, next week we'll look at the fossil record. We'll briefly look at that. We'll also look at the fossils when we talk about the flood of Noah, which is lesson number 9. But talk about the scientific evidence as far as fossils and how that either proves or disproves evolution. Any other questions or comments?
Well, I thank you because covering these scientific ideas might have made us appreciate our Bible that much more.
Who created science? God did. All the laws he put in place, God created it.